Social media both unites and divides us. How should we deal with it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. As people all over the country protest the police killing of George Floyd, social media is the medium for organizing, reporting, and amplifying marginalized voices. It is also where President Trump and politicians are responding, sometimes controversially. In just the past few days, Twitter has flagged the president's tweets, Snapchat essentially deplatformed him, bots and bad actors are swarming social media with misinformation, and yet, these platforms often spark the awareness of injustice in the first place. Nicole Turner Lee is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. She says these tools can be as powerful as they are dangerous.
I'm a huge fan of being able to use our technology to share our stories. That is how Black Lives Matter was created. But what we have to always also realize, you know, we need leadership to use that technology to also speak to the people. My heart sinks as what we're seeing sort of dictated and portrayed through technological interfaces as the new public square are giving us two visions of two Americas, where really there's one side that really cannot breathe right now during a pandemic, right? And we have no way out.
I was having this debate with a friend this morning, the same question where she was like, honestly, would everything be better if we just shut down Twitter? Seeing people attacked by the police is a form of abuse. And then we were like, but on the other hand, were it not for these mediums, the video of George Floyd's death would not have become public.
You know, you have platforms which are very dominant in terms of their medium. Print newspapers and local radio and television stations are becoming more and more extinct. And so there's not many places that people can turn to. And then the second thing is, like you said, you have a tool that has been used for organizing. My daughter showed me a tweet which basically said, hey, come down with your mask and your water and your phone charge, you know. And that's very different from the telephone tree of the 60s.
When you look at the difference in reaction between Twitter and Facebook, you know, civil rights leaders met with Facebook this week and came away saying this huge platform is not going to help. But on the other hand, it's like, does it really help that much if Twitter says we're going to hide this tweet behind this kind of weird filter, but it still exists?
You know, it is always very challenging, particularly since we know that conservatives feel biased when they actually interact with social media platforms. The same way, you know, I said tell my conservative friends that Black Lives Matter feels biased. The key thing is there's a responsible use of a platform, particularly we're in the midst of the civil unrest. Police brutality has been publicized and shown on Facebook for years, and I applaud them for that. But at the same time, even when the highest leader in the government is in a position to create the type of turmoil that would result in worse economic and racial stratification and inequalities, hold him accountable to the same way that you hold an individual from a militia group or an African-American who may be spouting rhetoric on their side. Don't exempt him.
Nicole Turner Lee is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. And today, we're going to give you a related interview. The Arab Spring and lots of other protests were organized on social media, but even since then, the technology has evolved. The tool of today's protests is the live stream. Violence by police, broken store windows, peaceful marching. We can still argue about what's happening, but in many cases, it's happening live for the world to see. Becca Lewis researches the politics of technology and media at Stanford. We talked to her about how the stories of these protests are being told.
Cable news has to fill a certain amount of time, so you have a lot of talking heads. It leads to favoring kind of in-studio PR statements. It leads to easy facilitation of communication between the police and the media. Whereas when you have on-the-ground coverage from individual citizens or independent news outlets, a lot of times you don't have those constraints. And one of the most striking cases I've seen of this on-the-ground coverage is the independent media organization Unicorn Riot, who has had an on-the-ground reporter throughout all of the Minneapolis protests. and also is spending a significant amount of time talking to the community members, which is something that you're really not getting kind of in the land of cable news or even print news.
When there is so much information, even more than there ever was, moving exponentially faster in real time, and we know there are, you know, big, huge coordinated disinformation campaigns, how are those campaigns taking advantage of this moment?
Yeah, I mean, disinformation campaigns thrive on confusion. And a lot of times the goal is not necessarily to get people specifically believing in one narrative or another. It's to seed doubt in people's minds. And because these protests are fairly structureless, they're not coming from a specific voice of leadership. They're open to, you know, various groups coming and attending and all of these things. There's a lot of room for interpretation. There's a lot of confusion even on the ground. And that in some ways becomes a perfect opportunity for disinformation merchants to inject their own narratives into the conversation and use it as an opportunity to sow discord.
But it sounds like you're saying to really have a 360-degree picture, do we need to be looking at all of it? You know, like, are we at a point where there just really is not one trusted source?
The reason that I point to groups like Unicorn Riot is because I actually think one of the biggest missing links here is the role that traditionally has been provided by local news. The people around this reporter recognized him, had seen him before, trusted him, and therefore were willing to share their stories with him. And I don't know how we're going to see more of that, what that means, but I do think that that local trust is a place to start.
Becca Lewis researches the politics of technology and media as a PhD candidate at Stanford. There is much more reading on this topic at marketplacetech.org about how there are cameras everywhere in America, for good or for ill. That's from the Washington Post. Taylor Lorenz wrote in the New York Times about supercuts of police violence that are racking up tens of millions of views online. And read more from The Verge about Snap's decision to stop promoting President Trump's account on its Discover page. The account will still exist and show up in search results, but it won't be amplified. Previously, Trump had showed up consistently in the app's Discover tab, and The Verge reported that his following has more than tripled in the last year as a result of the promotion. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.